You're listening to Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for January 16th. I'm Joe Elia. We offer news and an interview. This week's interview is with a pharmacoepidemiologist whose research team found a twofold increase in sudden cardiac deaths among users of both typical and atypical antipsychotics. But first, here are the week's other top medical headlines. First, checklists. Second, influenza guidelines. Third, Vicks VapoRub. Fourth, fractional flow reserve. What in blazes is that? Okay, some details. Checklists are coming to a medical institution near you, probably starting in the surgical suite, but they will catch on more widely. A study in the New England Journal of Medicine reports that a 19-point checklist given in an international trial lowered surgical complications by about a third and surgical mortality by half. What's not to like about that? Next, influenza. The CDC wants to remind you that this season's influenza A virus is highly resistant to oseltamivir, also known as Tamiflu. If the resistant bug is in your area, they recommend using zanamivir, also known as Relenza, as a first choice. Exposures warranting prophylaxis should also get zanamivir. How do you know if the resistant strain is in your area? Call the state health department and ask. Next, Vicks. We have the ferrets to thank for this finding. Applying Vicks VapoRub to the area just under the nostrils is a common practice, but alert your patients that doing this with young children could make a bad situation worse. Researchers report in the journal Chest that when an 18-month-old girl came in with acute respiratory distress for no identifiable reason, they suspected that her grandmother's application of Vicks right under the little one's nose was to blame. To investigate, they did some studies in ferrets and found that the ointment reduced ciliary activity in the trachea while increasing mucus secretion. Not a good combination. Their advice? Keep the stuff away from infants and children under two, use in whom isn't recommended anyway. Finally, fractional flow reserve, or FFR. What is it, and why do you have to know about it? Well, you may not need to know much about it unless you're placing stents and have to decide which vessels warrant stenting and which don't. The process can be tricky. Researchers report in the New England Journal of Medicine that stenting decisions made on the basis of angiography and FFR, and FFR is the ratio of maximal blood flow in a suspect vessel to maximal blood flow in a patent vessel, those decisions turn out to be better than those made on the basis of angiographic data alone. So now you know. Our interview is just ahead. We talk with Dr. Wayne Ray about his paper on antipsychotic drugs and sudden cardiac death. Here we go. The New England Journal of Medicine this week carries an analysis of Medicaid data from Tennessee showing that antipsychotic drugs, both typical and atypical, increase the risks of sudden cardiac death. The study examined 16 years of data on some 90,000 users of antipsychotics and almost 200,000 matched non-users. The authors found a doubled risk for sudden cardiac death among current users of the drugs. The effect was dose-related, and patients who were former users showed no greater risk than the non-using controls. We've asked Dr. Wayne Ray, the paper's first author, to talk with us about his findings. Dr. Ray is director of the Division of Pharmacoepidemiology and professor of preventive medicine at Vanderbilt. Thank you for talking with us this morning, Dr. Ray.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. What surprised you about the findings? Did you expect that both classes of drugs would show the sudden death risk?
When the atypical antipsychotics were introduced into wide practice in the mid-1990s, there was a great deal of hope that these would be much safer agents than the older typical drugs.
Yes.
And one of the dimensions on which we hoped they would be safer was with regard to their cardiac effects, and particularly sudden cardiac death. And thus, it's interesting that the finding of our study shows that the drugs, the newer drugs, in fact, are not safer with regard to sudden cardiac death than the older drugs. And so that's a finding that is perhaps somewhat unexpected to many. However, for the older drugs, the risk of sudden cardiac death is something that's related to the drug's effect on cardiac electrophysiology.
Mm-hmm.
There are studies showing that the older drugs block crucial potassium channels and that they also prolong the QT interval, both of which are markers for serious ventricular arrhythmias and risk of sudden cardiac death. When the atypical drugs were first introduced, these electrophysiologic studies hadn't been done. But over time, such studies were done, and they found, in fact, that the effects of the atypicals on potassium channels and on QT were not that different than those of the typicals. And so for that reason, perhaps our finding is not as unexpected as it might first seem.
And the effect of both classes of drugs is about the same. It was a kind of a doubling of risk. It was more pronounced in some drugs than others, but if you take them as classes, they both doubled the risk of sudden cardiac death. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And we did find, with regard to specific drugs, that after controlling for dose, the risk seemed to be greatest with thioridazine, and that is consistent with the electrophysiologic studies because thioridazine typically produces the greatest prolongation of the QT interval, and indeed the label for thioridazine carries a black box warning with regard to ventricular arrhythmias and sudden cardiac death. But apart from that, the estimates of the relative risk were very similar for the two classes of drugs and for the individual drugs within the classes. So I think the safest way to proceed is to assume that all members of this class confer this doubling of risk of sudden cardiac death.
The editorial makes an interesting comparison to this situation with clozapine, where the death rate from agranulocytosis, which is a known adverse effect of the drug, is one-tenth that of the sudden cardiac death risk. Do you think that your findings argue in favor of testing for, say, prolonged QT intervals in patients before giving them prescriptions to these antipsychotics?
Well, that's going to be a hard question, and I think probably people who know more about cardiology than I do are going to weigh in on it. But what I do think absolutely makes sense is, first, to restrict antipsychotic drug use to patients for whom it's essential. So, for example, if you have a patient with bipolar disorder who's not in an acute manic phase, the mood stabilizers such as lithium, valproic acid, and lamotrigine are perfectly fine drugs. They've been shown to have efficacy that's probably as good as that of the antipsychotics. So why not try those drugs first?
And they don't have that effect.
Exactly.
Right.
And secondly, when an antipsychotic is essential, it would seem crucial to do a cardiology workup. Sudden cardiac death is what people call a multiple hit phenomenon. That means that when it happens, it's typically the result of multiple risk factors. So when a patient is being started on an antipsychotic, it would seem prudent to make an effort to manage any other risk factors.
I see. Yeah, I did a rough calculation based on, you did a control panel to try to control for people who might be taking, I guess you could describe it better than I could, but you did a sort of a sub-analysis. And according to the numbers that I read in your paper, and I may be wrong, it seemed that two-thirds of the patients on antipsychotics didn't have an obvious reason to be on them. In other words, a psychosis or some other indication. Is that possible?
You know, one of the interesting things that's happened with the introduction of the atypicals is that the use of the antipsychotics has expanded greatly, perhaps doubling or tripling in the population. And that's because of the reduced frequency of movement disorders with the atypicals and just the general perception that they're much safer. And one of the characteristics of that expansion is that several atypical antipsychotics now have a labeled indication for bipolar disorder. And so the indications now are much broader than the old indication of schizophrenia and related psychosis. Furthermore, there's considerable off-label use. So I think, in summary, that means that the majority of antipsychotic use today is not for schizophrenia or related psychoses.
So it's off-label, perhaps?
No, much of it is off-label, but it's important to emphasize that the use for bipolar is not off-label.
Okay. All right.
That's in the label for many antipsychotics. But in some ways, in my mind, it makes more sense to think about this as, are there not in terms of on-label, off-label, but in terms of, are there alternatives or are there not alternatives? And for schizophrenia, there aren't really alternative drugs, but for these other conditions, there are.
Okay. So I was going to ask you, what should a clinician do with this information? And your answers so far are, you seem to be counseling, look for other drugs if the patient is in the class.
Yes.
Use
antipsychotics only when essential.
They are less likely to be essential, I think, if I'm reading your paper correctly, and among the aged population with dementia and among younger people. Is that right?
Yes, because the reasons for which they're used there are predominantly reasons for which there are other potential therapies. For example, in children, adolescents, and even a growing number of adults, there's fairly aggressive treatment of ADHD. And it turns out that antipsychotics are one of the drugs that's now being used for ADHD. Given their serious adverse effects, I think that a clinician should think long and hard before, you know, starting a 25 or 30-year-old or a 13-year-old on an antipsychotic with the intention of treating ADHD.
All right. What else are you working on these days, Dr. Ray?
Well, we're working on a lot of, I'm in a division of pharmacoepidemiology, so our job is to study medication effects in large populations. And we're actually just beginning a study of the safety of antipsychotics in children and youth.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing that when it comes out. I imagine you sitting at a workstation, by the way, and grinding your way through terabytes worth of Medicaid data. Is that your typical work day? You're sitting at using a SQL server or something like that?
Well, you know, it is a work that requires manipulation of very large amounts of data, but above all, it requires really a good team, and I want to take the opportunity to thank the other members of the team here who are actually listed on our paper. But the team will include experts in cardiology, such as the one on our paper, Dr. Murray, experts in clinical pharmacology, such as Dr. Stein, and computer programmers, such as Ms. Hall. And the computer programmers actually do most of the crunching.
Well, I want to thank you again for talking with us, Dr. Ray.
Well, thanks so much for talking with me, Joe. Take care.
Finally this week, it's all about sleep. At least your susceptibility to the common cold seems to be. The Archives of Internal Medicine reports that people with bad sleep habits, you know, like getting less than 7 hours of the stuff a night, or bad sleep efficiency, spending too much time in bed tossing and turning but not sleeping, it turns out that those people are 3 to 6 times more likely to catch a cold when challenged with a rhinovirus. Get to bed. Have a great week of healing. And if you want to comment or complain, call 617-440-4374. If you'd like links for any of the stories or access to any of our interviews, go to podcasts.jwatch.org. Our executive producer is Adoriano, and I'm Joe Elia, in charge of ensuring that our listeners get enough sleep. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to Admitting Diagnosis.